Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
World class. Jim Crockett Promotions. Big Time Wrestling. Mid-South. $2 Late Fee presents Territory Marks with Paul London and Zach Schaefer. The show that celebrates matches from the glory days of professional wrestling. From one man who lives it and another man who loves it.
All right, here we are, the inaugural episode of Territory Marks. Very excited to go down memory lane where my co-host and I talk about our favorite memories and matches from the 80s, sometimes 90s, maybe sometimes late 70s. But that pretty much taps out at 90, I'd say 92. It's me, Zach Schaefer. I'm one half of the team. Dustin's not here. This is a $2 late fee show, but Dustin knows zero about wrestling. So perhaps he'll come on a later episode and we can talk about it. Not zero. He said he knows from his action figure LJN days. He remembers some of the figures that he had and he can maybe go there. But no, joining me is, well, a man that I have the utmost respect for, huge fan of his career and what he's done inside the ring, on the screen, as an actor and a professional wrestler, Paul London. Paul, what's going on?
Zach, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. You know, even though, like you said, short-lived knowing each other, I can already tell you're my favorite tag team partner.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, this is just the chemistry, the things we have in common, the, you know, you even just mentioning about being a fan of early 80s and 80s. A bit exploitative horror films, but just the underground stuff, and that's right up my alley. So love that. And so when you presented this idea about doing Territory Marks, I started to salivate because I'm not a fan of current day wrestling. So what better thing to do than go down memory lane?
Thank God for YouTube. Yeah, and thank God for certain things that the WWE hasn't locked down yet. So right. Fortunately. Yeah, I really quickly, my backstory is I grew up watching wrestling, started out in the mid-80s, actually early 80s. I think my introduction was watching Big Time Wrestling in Detroit. My mom's PE teacher was George the Animal Steel.
No and, way.
Yeah, no joke.
Wow.
Listening to Dick the Bruiser on the local radio rock station, The Riff. Talking about his days in wrestling way back when. That's kind of how I got hooked into it, and the rest is history. You know, I love, in the onset of this, we talked about in the intro, we mentioned territories, and the territories in the 80s were a lot of different places all over the country before WWE basically became the Amazon or the Walmart of the business and owning everything. And there were all these little smaller territories like World Class Championship Wrestling and the CWA and the AWA and the NWA and Florida Championship. And I thought, you know what? Well, to be a mark, and if you don't know what that is, it's Paul, what is a mark?
A mark, you know, it's funny. That term originates from the carnival days, from what I've gathered. And basically, the carnival barker, as he would allow patrons to come through and get their ticket to go into the carnival, would keep some chalk or baby powder in his pocket. So he would put his hand in there and kind of get some powder on his hand. He'd be like, "Oh, right this way, sir, right this way." And he would pat them on the back and he would mark them.
Okay.
So that's how the rest of the people in the carnival knew, oh, there's a mark, right? He wouldn't do that to everybody, but like the people that were like very excited, just very, you know, ready to just willing to believe everything and just overexcited, right? So
yeah,
it's since kind of changed over the years. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like the ultimate fan, you know, the fan that'll be there through good times, bad times, good matches, terrible matches, you're a fan, you know, and we're all marks for one thing or another. Some people, unfortunately, are marks for themselves. But we don't have those people here. They're out of here. We threw them out of the territory. They went onward. We moved them out. They went on to the Carolinas. So
we sandpapered their foreheads in the back and sent them running. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, we put Crisco corn oil in their wind straw. I am admittedly a mark because I love professional wrestling. I really kind of fell in love with it, funny enough, through the magazines before I started seeing it on TV. So my young 11-year-old brain started to try and put things together and make sense of still images. And it wasn't until I started really watching it. Of course, my first real exposure was WWF and NWA, WCW. Mm-hmm. But growing up in Texas, we had some of the best territories. You know, we had Southwest Championship Wrestling. We had obviously World Class Championship Wrestling. So my father, he went to school at what I believe is now West Texas A&M something, but some of his classmates were the DiBiases, because like it was Ted DiBiase, Iron Mike DiBiase, his father. I believe Tito Santana went to this college. There were a lot of wrestlers that went through this college. But it wasn't something that my father and I sat down to watch wrestling with. If anything, they were more so worried that I would, you know, get the bug. But fast forward, my first real trainer was the Polish Power, Ivan Putski.
Wow.
He really broke me into the wrestling business. At first I tried to get training from Exotic Adrian Street, but he just ripped me off.
Man, that would have been wild.
Total carny move, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But then I was fortunate enough to get trained by Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk.
Wow.
I take a lot of pride in feeling as though I'm a bit of a crossover from territory type training, you know, that style of really weeding guys out and seeing if they're worthy of being in the ring. Because back then, you know, it was very cliquish. Very closed doors, and kayfabe was alive and well. And for a lot of people who don't know what kayfabe is another kind of carnival term, but it's basically what you'll say out into the locker room whenever there are marks present, meaning fans, people who aren't part of the show. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a bit of a keyword to protect the business.
Yeah,
you know, so if a heel and a face are talking about last night's shenanigans and, you know, you say kayfabe, you know, they'll separate immediately and whatever, just to try and protect the business.
Wow.
Yeah, it's something that I'm still a proponent of. I believe in kayfabe, and it takes a real commitment. But sadly, it's something that a lot of people feel is dead. I feel it's up to the performer. But if the people bought tickets, then they're there to believe something. And it's, you know, your job to make them believe.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, $2 late fee celebrates nostalgia from the 80s. And this is Territory Marks is a continuation of celebrating nostalgia from the 80s in the squared circle. You know, and we are going to talk about each episode. We're going to talk about one match each. We each bring a match to the episode to talk about. Sprinkling in some pop culture moments at the end from that time, just like we do on $2 late fee. So there's a little bit of a continuation there. And Paul and I are, we ahead of time, we have to watch the matches, obviously, so we know what we're talking about. But getting to the first episode and figuring out which matches to kind of start with was a big deal. Because if you go into the first match with something that's going to just flame out in 30 seconds, you know, what the hell are you listening to this podcast for? You want something to, it's going to bring fire, right? Yeah. So it was a tough decision for both of us. In fact, after I chose my first match, I went back and forth. I'm like, should I have picked a different match? I don't know. Because obviously mine was really quick. And I've said this before on $2 late fee. To this day, I go to bed sleeping thinking about wrestling. When I was a kid, I was playing with my action figures, and I didn't like the old school LJN Galoob figures because they couldn't move them, right?
The big kind of rubber, you know, I think they were probably this. They had some good size, but yeah, no mobility.
They were like 10 or 11 inches tall, right? They were huge, right? Yeah. And then the Galoob ones that came out later on from WCW were a smaller version of that, but still didn't move. Anyways, I had, and I think your brother, and you'll appreciate this, your brother Jonathan from Geekscape, I had the Superpower DC figures, and I had the Marvel Secret War figures, and those had some pretty decent articulation for back in the day, and I had a wrestling ring that was about the size, it was like my AWA Remco ring, nice. Made out of cardboard, which I still own, by the way.
No way.
With all the figures, too, most of them. I'll have to bust that out sometime when we get to him. Well, actually, should have. I don't have any. Well, I don't want to spoil that. Anyways, I used those wrestlers for my. I used those toys for my wrestlers. And as I got older and stopped playing with toys, it went all into the memory bank, all into the box. And I renamed a lot of these characters to my own, like, wrestling character names, right? And to this day, I have storylines that date all the way back to the 80s. Just continuation. Wow. And it's a variation on some of the matches that I'll talk about in this series that that I loved. You know, people swerving other people.
Sure.
You know, stuff like that. So I go, my meditation to go to bed at night is thinking about wrestling. And so I kind of eat, sleep, and drink it. And it's, a, you know, it's been always a big deal to me to want to bring it to $2 late fee. And here we are. And it's an honor to have you tag teaming with me. And so I was like, Paul, it's got to be me and Paul. The worlds are aligning right now. I can feel it, brother.
You so, can use my boots.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Mine, by the way, are cowboy wrestling boots. And I should have worn those in the, for the occasion. Maybe I am. This is for the everyone listening. Maybe we're wearing those wrestling boots with the cowboy.
Have our bleached jeans tucked into the cowboy boots with no belt.
Right.
Fanny packs.
With those fanny packs. Oh, my God.
That's where we keep our gimmicks.
Yes, exactly. So are you ready to get into this? Are you ready to talk about these matches?
And real quick, I think what else is so wonderful about what you presented here with Territory Marks is that, you know, some of these matches might be familiar to the viewer and the listener, but fortunately we'll find some matches in hopes that you can then look up yourself and really start opening up that own kind of, it is Pandora's box, because you will become re-addicted to genuine, real professional wrestling. And I guess there is a warning here that if you're watching current wrestling on television, you might not be as excited about that stuff after watching some of these matches. So.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think for those that are listening that are not wrestling fans but love the show anyways, we might make you a fan. You might be a mark by the time this episode ends or the future ones do.
If you're watching this, you already are a mark.
Yeah, that's right, brother. All right, so we're going in chronological order. We're talking about two matches tonight, both from the 80s. And Paul's going to start us off with his match. Paul, what is the match that you brought to tonight's episode?
Well, similar to you, I was going back and forth over countless matches. It was kind of, you know, the mindset of it has to be something so epic. And, you know, and there's so many to choose from because, you know, this was life. This was life. These were wrestlers, true wrestlers. These were people that you didn't want to meet outside in a dark alley. These were people that you believed. These were people that looked the part. They lived the part. They were the part. They dragged their families, you know, their wives, their children, their mistresses. They dragged them across the country, depending on what territory was having them come in to start a program. You know, maybe there was a need for a babyface in San Francisco, or they needed a hot heel down in San Antonio. And you could pretty much just pick up and take off on a note's notice. There's a story going back to when Tully Blanchard used to work for his father, Joe Blanchard, I believe in San Antonio. And Tully got into a bar fight and kind of got whooped. And his father was so embarrassed, he shipped him right out of the territory. He's like, what can I do with you now? Like, so you're out of here. You're going to the Carolinas. You leave like tomorrow.
Yeah, because he pretty much jobbed out at the bar, right?
Yeah, and like, you know, word was going to travel. So it was like, that's how serious kayfabe is. So I thought a lot about this, and it literally, a good friend of mine as well, kind of just helped calm me down. He's one of my wrestling encyclopedias, but he said, you know what, just go with what you dig. And what I dig is tag team wrestling. I made a lot of my living in the ring was a tag team specialist. And when I think of the career that I had in tag team wrestling, a tag team that was very influential to myself and a few of my partners were the Rockers. Mm. But before they were the Rockers in the WWF, they were the Midnight Rockers in the AWA. And one of their biggest feuds was with the Playboy, Buddy Rose, and the Pretty Boy, Doug Summers.
The challengers, at a combined weight of 475 pounds, Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, the Midnight Rockers. Their opponents, the tag team champions of the world, brought to the ring
teams had a series of matches, and Doug Summers and Buddy Rose, they had just won the tag team championships from Scott Hall, who would later on be known as Razor Ramon, and Kurt Hennig, who would later go on to be Mr. Perfect. And this was before Vince McMahon kind of poached the different territories of who he wanted. And that's kind of what led to the end of the territories. Yeah. Sadly, was Vince McMahon doing just that. He poached the territories, all their greatest talents, and put them on TV repackaged as something that he thought was marketable. And a lot of those went on to great success, and some of them didn't. So this feud between Doug Summers, Playboy Buddy Rose, and the Midnight Rockers, who were a very young Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, I feel that this is really what helped elevate Shawn and Marty, to put them in the kind of in the scope where they were noticed by WWF. Apparently it was Pat Patterson that took note of them and was like, we really need to sign these guys.
Okay.
But had they not gone through this feud with Doug Summers and Buddy Rose, I don't know that would have happened, because this truly elevated them to real players in the business, especially for being in their early 20s. So the match that I selected was one that it actually occurred on August 30th, 1986, but it aired on September 2nd, so just a few days later. And this is back on ESPN, when ESPN had professional wrestling.
Wow.
And now they have bowling and darts. Bring back the real pro wrestling.
Seriously.
So, yeah, and this was from the Showboat Casino in Las Vegas, which – as far as I could tell from what I noticed, that was kind of closed in January of 2004, sadly, but it was a mess, for some of the biggest matches around. AWA, I believe, had a contract with it, and they had some of their big, big shows at the Showboat Casino, and it just creates a great atmosphere. So yeah, as I was thinking about it and thinking of a match to select, it seemed like the perfect choice. This is a tag team match that is brilliant, like in so many ways. You have the pompous, cocky heels who are veterans, just wily veterans. Like I said, they had just won the tag belts, I believe back in May of 86, from extremely accomplished Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig.
Two beefy guys.
Right. Yeah, big beefy guys. And you know, AWA was mainly running a lot of like the Minnesota area, but they were running, you know, Midwest. So for them to come and do these shows in Vegas, it was kind of like a pretty big deal. You know, it was like where they would have a blow off. Who they would have at ringside as their lovely and dastardly valet was Sherry Martel. And what's funny to note about a lot of this is that, you know, some 6, 7, 8 years later, Shawn Michaels would adopt Sherry Martel as his valet when he went heel as the sexy boy Shawn Michaels and turned on Marty Jannetty much later in WWF. So it's kind of neat to see where a lot of these seeds were kind of put out there, you know, early on, and to think that, you know, this established a lot of things that later would grow on to something else, you know. And 10 years after this match, Shawn Michaels would be WWF champion. So if you're a fan of Shawn Michaels, if you're a fan of Marty Jannetty, if you're a fan of real tag team wrestling, and if you're a fan of just gritty, just down and dirty heels who aren't concerned with being cool or doing the cool moves, this is the match for you. I mean, this match, as I mentioned, it's perfect psychology of your heels and your faces. Literally 5 minutes into this match, Shawn Michaels gets dumped to the apron, and as Buddy Rose draws the referee's attention, Doug Summers goes and grabs Shawn and drags him across the apron and rams his head into the turnbuckle bindings, which is like a metal, that's how they used to tighten the ropes back then. Yeah, it's like a turnbuckle.
Yeah,
I know, because I've busted my own head up on these before.
Oh,
but it turns into a bloodbath. You know, this match is an absolute bloodbath. So 5 minutes into what was about an 18-minute match, I believe three of these guys all get busted open throughout the course of this match. Both Shawn, Marty, and Doug Summers are showing some real color here, real color. And traditionally, the babyface would draw color to really garner more sympathy. So the thing that I truly love about this match so much is the selling here, because that's ultimately what's going to make these people believe. And the house is so raucous. Like, they're just so into everything, every movement, every raising the fist to show that there's still fight, every wild swing. I mean, just everything, even just the kickouts to show that they're still alive. There was very much just tons and tons of heat on Buddy Rose and Doug Summers.
Big time.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's a work of art. It's a work of art. And funny enough, the match ends in a DQ, you know. So it's not like there was a definitive kind of, we're going to see the big title switch. But it was just so much of just the fight of the baby faces. And there's a double heat here, which, for those who don't know, heat is when the heel is really taking a beating and putting a beating on the baby face. He's done something dastardly behind the ref's back, ideally cheating. You never really kind of wanted the heel to outsmart the baby face, because then the baby face would kind of look like a doofus. So genuinely, you know, the baby face would come out firing, full of house, you know, just full of fire. And it would get the heel on it, you know, on his heels, so to speak.
Yeah.
So having tag team wrestling really afforded so many other avenues for there to be stuff done behind the referee's back. And so, like I mentioned, you know, 5 minutes into the match, Shawn gets busted open. And it's a beautiful color job. You don't see the blade. You don't see any of that. But no. he's just a crimson mask.
Yeah.
A crimson mask. And he's just showing that fight. He is showing that fight. Actually, early on, right before he gets busted open, you see the very early shades of the super kick. They would call it a crescent kick or a martial arts kick because they didn't, you know, the super kick hadn't been invented.
Yep.
But you couldn't ask for better foils than Buddy Rose and Doug Summers because they sold their asses off too. And they knew when to put the right amount of heat on there, when to change gears, when to ramp it up, when to throw them to the outside and draw the referee so that Sherry or the other partner could do stuff behind the ref's back and throw them back in and do the, like, I didn't touch him, you know, right. And then, you know, Sean eventually makes the tag to Marty, who's just gangbusters. He's just going wild, full of fire. And he's just unloading, and then he's unloading, and he's taking them both out. But then eventually he even gets busted open, and now he's a crimson mask. And now they're putting the heat on Marty, and it's like, oh, my God, they're never going to make it. There's no way. There's no way. You know, it's funny because Buddy Rose was the only one who didn't color in this match. He didn't get busted open. But it's just beautiful. I love this match so much, and it's just – it's a real work of art, and it's like tag team wrestling in the most, these guys are all maestros of what they're doing. And to think of Sean and Marty in their early 20s, it's amazing. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
You know? And these aren't bodybuilders, you know, like no. Doug Summers, they called him he was the pretty boy, but you look at Buddy Rose and they would call him the doughboy.
Yeah.
But just great, great heels. And, you know, it takes great faces to make great heels, and it takes great heels to make great faces.
Totally.
I feel that this is the match that truly elevated the Midnight Rockers to just another level. And it's funny because later on, once, you know, it breaks down and it's DQ'd, there's a moment where I want to say it's at the 20-minute mark, after the locker room's emptied and some different baby faces have run out.
Greg
there to
Gagne,
try.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, I had to get
Daddy's boy
camera. Absolutely. But if you look at the 20-minute mark, there's blood drops on the camera.
Oh.
So there's a bit of blood on the camera lens. Yeah, it's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. And
I didn't notice that. Wow.
Yeah, there's a big glob of blood right on the camera lens. Mark. So.
That's wild. Well, I will say too, okay, so I mean, I have a lot. I'm like chomping at the bit here because I'd never seen this match before. I remember the rivalry these two teams had back in the day. I believe on the Shawn Michaels story, the WWE disc that they put out years ago, they touched on this a little bit, like the birth of the Midnight Rockers, who, by the way, came out to the theme of Living After Midnight by Judas Priest, and we'll talk about the music later, but which great theme. And Buddy and Summers, you know, that was a different era, right? Where the dudes like looked like nothing, but they could beat the holy hell out of you. Yeah. And it reminded me a little bit like, you know, Wildfire Tommy Rich. That guy shouldn't, by today's standards, should never been an NWA champion. But he was at one point, which is pretty wild. Yeah. These guys, there's no way in hell these guys nowadays would have been world tag team champions, you know, by today's standards. Probably not. But my God, they sold it left and right. They were such great heels. The Midnight Rockers, I mean, I'm unabashedly a huge Jannetty fan.
And same here.
I mean, he and honestly, I think he could use a better talker before Sean, but that's a whole other story. And those two, like Sean is in the ring. It's like you said, it's an 18-minute match, but Sean's in the ring for 12 minutes, the first 12 minutes of the match. I tracked it. I'm like, when's he going to make a tag? Because this is insane.
Mark hadn't been in the ring yet.
No. And then when he gets in, it's like 2 minutes in and he's bloody, you know, and it's what a story. And like you said, to see Sherry pop up out of nowhere, like I forgot that she managed those guys and she was around this business for such a long time. And what a iconic female presence in the ring and outside the ring. in a talk or two, everything. But this moment, this capsule, reminded me of the AWA had such a unique look, right? Even the way, the positioning of the camera, the hard cam, typically one guy is on like the left side and one guy's on the right. Well, these are like facing the one guy's facing the camera. The other guy, the other teammate is, his back is to the camera. Right. It was just an interesting perspective. And I kind of liked it, to be honest with you. I was like, this is cool to see the action from a different point of view.
Definitely lends itself to it appearing as a legitimate sport, you know, which is probably why ESPN aired it and had it, you know, as one of their regular programs. But also the commentating, I think, just lends itself to it being legitimate in a sport, you know, and it was just, it's such a wonderful thing to witness. And you really see the fire behind the Bay Faces not giving up and digging deep. And they're throwing wild punches because they're both just bleeding. And, you know, even when Doug Summers gets busted open in the turnbuckle as well, he gets thrown into that turnbuckle twice.
I believe. It's dramatic. Yep.
And he falls back, and his blade job maybe wasn't as secretive as Sean's.
No.
But Sean had the luxury of kind of putting his head under the ring skirt outside doing it. Nowadays, you'll just see the guys, you know what I mean? And it's embarrassing. Because, you know, you would think you getting your head busted on a piece of metal, it's going to gash you open.
Yeah, because it's exposed. Like that turnbuckle is padded, but right behind it, like you were describing, that kind of metal bracket that binds the ropes together, that's totally unexposed. And so the fact that Sean gets his head cracked hard on that thing, so legit, I believed it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. And he's out of the ring long enough for him to do what he needs to do out there. So by the time he gets back in, it feels so authentic and dramatic, and he sells like nobody, you know, as such a young kid.
Absolutely. And I love that Marty jumps down and runs around to check on him, even though he's in bad guy territory, you know, it's like right at the heels corner, but he's kind of just like, God, you know what I mean? Like I need to check on him. Like, he's, you know, and that just, he really just shows that unification of a real tag team.
And also too, you know, I showed this match to my son, and my son is 8 and he watches a lot of wrestling. I was watching wrestling with him when he was a little baby. We were watching a War Games match, and I'm like, you're not going to remember this, but
he's such a great dad.
His first Halloween costume that he chose was Sting, Surfer Sting. So anyways, it's so great. So great. But, I watched this match with him. And again, there's you're not seeing the moveset that you see nowadays, but he was like, oh, like reacting to every punch, every kick. And he's like, wow, this is intense. I go, yeah, this feels like a real fight. Like these guys, I said, bud, it's kayfabe. They probably do get along, but these guys hate each other in the ring. Like they are just tearing it up. And Marty, the Midnight Rockers were such a unique team. I mean, we had other teams that Rock and Roll Express, for example, that another team I love. But these guys were young. Like the Rock and Roll Express looked like they were in their 30s because they were in their 30s. These guys looked like they were in their 20s and they looked like little kids and so much more relatable. You look in that audience and you talked about the audience was on fire. That's a make or break situation too. Like if the audience is dead, it takes the energy out of the match, and they were so into it and next to it too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they're going crazy, crazy. And there's a lot of young and a lot of old in that crowd. And I don't think Doug Summers and Buddy Rose had too many fans, and that's how they would want it. You know what I mean? Those were heels that loved and relished being hated because that's what drew money. Because when it came time for you to get your ass whipped, like that was going to draw money. And that's what they were paying tickets to see you eventually get your comeuppance. So in a match like this, where sure, ideally you would think, oh my God, like they fought through just blood and agony and pain and everything. And they finally won the tag belts. Like, nope, they're going to have to wait. Like we're going to draw that out. So the booking's brilliant, you know, in my opinion, because you're giving the fans right on the edge of, are they going to win? Are they going to win? They haven't given up. They haven't given up. And then it's like, oh, DQ, like, oh no, God, you know, and always have the fans go home craving more.
How are they going to beat these guys? Like, how are they going to do this? And they, yeah, you know, it makes you want to buy the ticket for the next show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny thinking about that turnbuckle being exposed. I remember one of my first cruiserweight title defenses took place in San Diego at the San Diego Sports Arena, I believe. And I had gotten pulled into the turnbuckle by my trunks as I was starting to fight back. This was against an ex-partner, Billy Kidman. And there was a bolt exposed behind the turnbuckle padding, and my head went right into it.
Ooh.
And it just started gushing bad. And I ended up getting 22 staples in my head.
Wow.
But you could sense the atmosphere of the match. You could sense the intensity elevate, because I was covered in blood and they kept asking me if I wanted to stop, but there was no way I was gonna stop, you know what I mean?
Right.
Fighting, and we ended up getting through it, and I ended up rolling them up for the pin. And it's one of the better moments I've had in my career, where I felt that, you know, and this was all by accident, getting busted open.
Yeah.
It's called hard way, as we say, when you get busted open legit. And it really, the audience responded in a way that I hadn't had before. And then I ended up getting jumped afterwards by two heels. And there was a ton of heat. It was one of my favorite memories. So when I think of watching this match in particular and just seeing that fight, I mean, I was just breathing that. And it wasn't anything to the level of what these guys did, because to me, this was just a master class in tag team wrestling with heels and baby faces, and just the selling. That's what I just love so much, though, is just the selling, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny, because you say when your son was watching it, and it wasn't all these crazy moves that you see today, but it was legitimate moves. It was stuff that you could see done in a bar fight that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And it's done as legit as possible. And it's believable. It's believable. Yeah. It's absolutely believable. And again, that's one of the things I loved about the heels. They weren't trying to be cool by doing, you know, this and that and innovation and all this kind of nonsense. They were just mean. They just wanted to beat you down and beat you at any, you know, opportunists. That's what the original, you would call a heel an opportunist, because it's like, there's a way to take advantage, they'll do it, you know, by hook or by crook. So just a beautiful match. I absolutely love it. And who knows, we might cover a couple more of the matches in this feud.
I hope so, because I really dig seeing, especially Buddy Landell. I only remember him kind of as a jobber in the later days of NWA, early days of WCW, seeing him pop up and not knowing who he was. And then I think on that documentary, the WWF documentary back at the time, they put out they paid a nice tribute to those guys. And you know, Sean even, you know, put him over. He was like, no, they really helped us kind of get our start. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Really beautiful. Yeah. No, I love it. Great match.
And I'm glad, by the way, I'm glad you're still alive after 22 staples in the back of your head. And
that was nothing. That was nothing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, they're like, do you want to cut a promo? Let's clean you up first. I'm like, no, you're not cleaning me up. We're doing the promo like this.
Blah, hell yeah.
Yeah. So
hard way, baby. Come on.
That's right, man. As real as it gets. That's right. I still feel it. Feels like a set of loops on my head.
Wow. Jeez. So are there some fun nostalgic facts you pulled from 1986? September of 1986.
I mean, I was 6 years old at this time. And so I was trying to think back. I mean, there were so many great films that came out. Obviously, we were in kind of like the Reagan era.
Yes.
At this point. But The Fly was leading the box office. That had topped the box office, which is still to this day a very tough film to watch. I mean, it's body horror personified. I mean, it's really fantastic film. And still to this day, one of Jeff Goldblum's standout performances, as well as Gina Davis. But I would think that this is one of Cronenberg's, babies, and it's absolutely fantastic. So great film. Wasn't totally surprised agree. To see that at the box office. Although, people love horror.
I saw that opening weekend with my mom with a double feature of that and Aliens. So,
oh wow. And I mean, absolutely another classic, one of my absolute favorites. Absolutely yep. love it, which is just, oh man. Did you know that James Remar was Hicks originally?
Yeah. Yep.
You saw that, right?
I saw the photos. It's wild. Yeah. James Remar, cool. Ajax from the Warriors. You guys know how much we love him.
Yeah.
Could have been Hicks.
Just the different stories about what went on behind the scenes there. It's kind of crazy. Yeah. Apparently there was an accident with one of the guns and he blew a hole through one of the set next door at Pinewood. I think it was blew a hole in the Little Shop of Horrors set or something. And they're like, oh, you're out of here. So in came Michael Biehn. I love Aliens, but I I'm not surprised. What a double bill. Aliens and the Fly.
I remember my mom took on my other podcast, Podcasting After Dark. We talk about my mom taking me to a lot of horror films, probably showing me things I maybe should have waited a few years to see, but whatever, turned me into the guy I am today. So
no, and I can't say that I had all my whereabouts at 6 years old. You know what I mean? I'm just playing outside and looking for lizards and pretending I'm a ninja and.
Amazing. I love it.
Bananarama's Venus was the top song at this time.
Oh, nice.
That was what was leading the charts was Venus. So it wasn't one of my go-to songs, but I do kind of remember being in the minivan with my mom and listening to top 40 or whatever. And
yeah,
right. I mean, absolutely.
Did they do Cruel Summer also?
They did. Yeah.
Okay.
Which wasn't, funny enough, it's the only song not on the Karate Kid soundtrack.
Yeah.
Even though it's in the film.
So wrong.
But it's not on the soundtrack. And I'm like, this is the song I want to hear the most.
That's a running theme on our show. We always talk about the songs that didn't wind up on the soundtrack or the soundtrack that never got released. And it's very frustrating.
Yeah. No, it's a bummer. But it really brought me back because I started thinking about all the cartoons that I would watch at this time. And, I was a huge G.I. Joe guy. And so, G.I. Joe, He-Man and the Master of the Universe, even Gem and the Holograms is a show that I would watch from time
Hell
to
yeah.
time. You know what I mean? I mean,
dare I say, I like it more now than I did way back then.
Oh yeah. No, I'm sure. And, I didn't see the film. That was like,
no, you don't need to just okay. watch the reruns with, watch the cartoon with Rio and, anyways,
no, it was pretty neat. Funny enough though, another one of my favorite movies before I forget about it was, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 came out like a week before this match took place.
Wow.
Well, yeah. That's one that gets kind of dumped on quite a bit, but
I love it. I love it. And in fact, Bill Moseley, I have an autographed metal plate from Bill Moseley. It says, "Lick my plate, you dog dick." And I spent $15 on a hanger that he bent into the shape of the hanger from the movie. So I have that somewhere too. My son's like, "What's this for?" I'm like, "Not anything bad."
It's like, "That's for the areas you can't reach." You know?
It's a back scratcher, son. It's a back scratcher.
But the NES was out.
Oh, yeah.
Teddy Ruxpin was out. I didn't have the Teddy Ruxpin. I certainly didn't have my buddy, which I don't think came. I think that came along just a little bit after this.
Yeah, it did.
Until Child's Play came out. And then it was like, we got to take this off the shelves. But I did have Garbage Pail Kids. Not a good movie either.
Nope.
Kind of scary.
Disturbing,
as a kid.
Yeah,
very disturbing. But one thing it was taking me back, and I was like, I remember I had that was Water Ring Toss. Do you remember that toy?
With the buttons.
Yeah, and it had looked like little skinny Fruit Loops in it, and you would get them hooked on and stuff. Yeah. I used to entertain myself so much with that thing.
I had the basketball one with the little basketballs.
Basketball one worked too. I mean, they're just, you know, and you don't need technology for these games. but you know, Tetris was out, Mario Brothers was out, Donkey Kong, Legend of Zelda. But also a toy that I'd forgotten about was the Pogo Ball.
Do you remember the Pogo
Ball? It looked like Saturn.
Yeah.
You know, with the ball, and you'd kind of just try to pinch the ball with your feet and jump up and down on that thing until you lost
it. I was terrible at it. I had zero coordination.
Oh, I think most people, because it wasn't like a big platform that you're sitting on, or standing on, I'm saying. But I miss a lot of these toys. I feel for the kids today that, you know, you walk down the aisle at Target or Walmart or whatever, and you see the toys, and it's kind of like, no, that's just, they just don't have the soul of the toys that we had back then, you know?
Like, no, I mean, I will say the action figures look phenomenal from where they were. Like, talk about wrestling figures. The wrestling figures now have every articulation you can think of, and they make the legends that look just like the guys in the ring. But the practical toys, the toys you could use as a kid that could get you physically fit, or a game you could play for a long period of time, they don't make them like that. They don't make them like that anymore.
Yeah, back in our day, kids, you young whippersnappers, if only you knew what you're missing out on. But, you know, Miami Vice, that was one of the top shows. It's still a show that I watch religiously today, with box sets, of course.
Same.
But, yeah, that was a show that I remember watching with my dad, because that was a show that he was pretty into. He wasn't one of those dads that tried to dress like Crockett or anything and want to be one of those cool dads, but he just enjoyed it. And I didn't quite appreciate it at 6 years old, you know, like cocaine and hookers and all. I didn't understand, you know, and, drug runners and all this kind of stuff.
I didn't get it either, but I love it. I loved it.
I love it. I love it. And the music is so iconic, you know? Yep. I mean, they used to spend, I think, up to 10 grand per episode just on music. And it was,
it's wonderful that it's out, the box sets that are on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever have all those songs, so you don't feel like you're, you know, getting a tainted version of this.
Right. Like the WWE owned stuff where they've put their generic music back over, you know, the old ECW shows or whatever. Yeah, no, I'm with you. It's keep it intact. But another show that I was a big fan of was MacGyver. That was a big show. You know, and I can still hear that theme song in my head because it's pretty iconic in its own right. But there was just, you know, what a great time for television. 80s television and cinema, how can you go wrong?
1986 was a very good year for pop culture in general.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm barely scratching the surface.
Oh, I know.
You
know,
we could do a whole hour just on the pop culture stuff, what came out in 86.
I know. I held back. I held back on my selections because I was like, I want to make sure there's a lot of matches from this particular year that I probably want to talk about. So,
cool. Well, yeah, no, I mean, please, if you want to take the stage, I'm ready for this. Talk about this classic match.
My match is Sting versus the Great Muta from NWA Power Hour, September of 89.
We've been waiting for it the entire Power Hour, and now it's time. The wrestlers are ready. The announcers are ready. The fans are ready. And we are ready. It's time for this week's Power Hour main event. Let's go to the arena.
What an ovation for this capacity crowd. Here watching the NWA Wrestling Power Hour. Perhaps the most popular athlete in all the professional sports. Right there in your camera. Coming right into your living room. And he is ready for the fight of his life here on the Super Stage. Say what you want to about anybody, and there's some top talent in the NWA right now, Jim Ross. But this thunderous ovation, you're looking at the future of the NWA right on your television screen. I think so. It's going to be Sting. The introduction made it very clear that this is for the disputed television championship because of the decision and the controversy.
I believe it aired September 1st. So a quick backstory. And if we don't hit the description of every territory every episode, we will. These territories will come up on a regular basis. So we will be talking more in depth on certain aspects of these territories. But and the wrestlers behind these matches. In July of 89, Sting, who was probably the top babyface of the NWA, soon to become the main babyface for many, many years, wrestled the Great Muta at the Great American Bash, and they wrestled to a double pin. So for those that don't know, basically their shoulders were both down on the ring at the same time, and it was like a double loss, right? for the TV title. Great Muta was the champion at the time. Sting was the challenger. So this was Sting's rematch. The title was kind of up, was being held up, and this was the match to decide who was going to get the belt. Up until this point, Sting started connecting with Ric Flair. Ric Flair was a babyface, and he was feuding with Terry Funk. This all will tie in together. Ric Flair was, I think, a heel for up until the point that he wrestled Ricky Steamboat earlier that year, beat Ricky Steamboat for the world title. Terry Funk pile drove Ric Flair through a table in one of the most vicious pile drivers ever, I think I've seen during that up until that point. And Flair was out of commission for a bit with a injured neck, comes back, battles Funk at the Bash in a wild match. And Funk had aligned himself with the Great Muta and Gary Hart, who, if you don't know who Gary Hart is, boy, oh boy, he's going to come up a lot on this show as well, because he's the master. The guy's a master. And so Sting came to the rescue because Sting was feuding with Muta. Kind of makes sense that the two of those guys would link up. So Great Muta, really quick, is Japanese wrestler. He's being inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame the weekend that this episode drops. Congratulations to him, because he deserves it. He came to the States in the 80s wrestling under the name, I think, like the White Ninja or the White...
You got me.
White Ninja. Yeah, awesome. He was the White Ninja. He came to the States in the White as the White Ninja, wrestled in World Class for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And then wound up in NWA in 89 and was introduced as the Great Mota, M-O-T-A.
Mota.
And he was the son of the Great Kabuki, which is another famed wrestler. But Gary Hart was his manager, and he was something to be reckoned with. You know, Sting, who had been in the NWA at this point for a couple years. Prior to that, he was in the CWA and the UWF with Jim Hellwig when they were the Blade Runners, I believe. And side note, there will be times when I'm pulling up facts, and there will be times when I'm just pulling from my memory bank, like pretty much Paul did the entire time. So, so Sting, you know, obviously had face paint on, and then the Great Muta shows up, scares the hell out of people with his face paint. He had a move set that I don't think many people had seen up until that point. Sting was considered a high flyer. He would do a big splash, drop kicks, stuff like that. But Muta had the moonsault, which I had never seen until he brought it into the ring. Handspring backflip that he would do. Just crazy moves for a time when we were not accustomed to that here in the United States. At least I wasn't. He wrestled Sting, like I said, to the draw or the double pin. And then they had this match on the NWA Power Hour. And it was a 15-minute match. You had everything in this match. You had interference from outside. Terry Funk shows up out of nowhere, starts getting involved in the match. Gary Hart is being the scumbag manager, interjecting and upsetting the match. You had the ref getting knocked out. Just like you did in... Actually, this match and Paul's match are very similar, because... You had a heel manager, you had referees getting knocked out, and you eventually, this match ends in a disqualification with Sting getting the win. But he doesn't get the title. Muta wrestles two nights later and then claims the World Television title, which I believe he holds for, over a year, until Arn Anderson defeated him for it.
Who did he beat 2 days after this? Did it? Do you remember? Like,
I didn't pull that up, to be honest with you. My bad.
No. I'm curious if it was. It wouldn't have been like. It wouldn't have been. That one stumps me as well.
Yeah. That may be something that we will have to put in our. We'll have to come back for that. Maybe that'll be a match worth revisiting. And what I love about this is this match was the middle of so many great storylines. You have the eventual formation of the Four Horsemen with Sting, which Four Horsemen was a heel stable, and suddenly they bring this ultra babyface. It gets really complicated in the most dramatic way. Is maybe one of my favorite dramatic moments of NWA. This match itself was back and forth nonstop. The entrance music is great. By the way, we'll put links to these matches in our show notes so you guys can watch these. But Sting comes out to his theme music, which was like a variation on, I think, like a Metallica song. It's just that bam, bam, bam. I might play a little clip of that. And then Muda comes out with his mystical music, which was so creepy at the time. So good. I might play a little bit of that too. And these guys tore it up for 15 minutes and they could have kept going. I mean, Muta like never looked tired, and Muta would spray green spray face paint. And I don't think he was the first to ever do that, but he definitely was the first to really bring it to the United States. And then obviously Tajiri was somebody who you would do it later on and blah, blah, blah. But
did that as well. Kabuki, I think, did that. Yeah,
Kabuki did do that as well. You're right. And so, and then the last thing I'll say about this, not only was the crowd hot, but you, in my opinion, have one of the best commentating teams, Jim Ross and Jim Cornette, doing the commentating. And it is Jim Cornette who will come up as a heel manager on this show. Jim Ross, to me, like his voice, he and Bob Caudle and Gordon Solie are like, to me, like the voices of wrestling for this era. And I watched this match three times over the course of about a month, because I absolutely love it. And in fact, I have the Sting Galoob figures. Back in the day, I have three different ones, because they released a bunch of different ones. I have Sting with the blue tights, I have Sting with the black tights, and Sting with the orange tights.
Wow. I had the one in the middle.
Yeah, with the title. And
does he have the rat tail?
It's the rat tail.
Yeah.
Which is so great. So Sting, for those of you that don't know, go to our Instagram. We've got pictures of all of the participants to all these matches. But Sting had a wicked rat tail back in the day. I loved it. So I'm going to turn it over to you. I want to get your thoughts on Sting versus Muda, NWA Power Hour, September of 89.
You know, I love this match. I hadn't seen it in... I can't tell you the last time I had seen it. So when you presented it, it was just, you know, and I, getting into wrestling, I was more a WWF guy than a WCW guy. Like, it just was more accessible and, you know, but I loved WCW at the same time. I had a WCW US title, the foam belt with the Velcro. I had a lot of these things. I had that Sting figure. I wanted a Mr. Perfect figure so bad that I bought the Sid Vicious figure of that line, because it was blonde. He had a singlet, even though it was black. And what, either way,
it looked like he was taking a dump, by the way. He kind of had this like horse stance.
Yeah. But one of the things that really initially kind of stands out when I'm seeing this match is, you know, Sting was just so mega over, and he hadn't even reached, you know, he wasn't near reaching the peak of his success or his being over. But early on in the match, even right as he gives out one of his, like, whatever he does, like that howl, whatever, like the place just goes crazy.
Nuts.
Goes crazy. Yeah. And, you know, Muda, say what you will, I mean, he was just, we had seen martial arts done from wrestlers previously, you know, from the Orient.
Yes.
But his looked, I feel, the most legit, you know, because he had real size on him. You know, I mean, he's a big guy. I've never personally met him, but, you know, you never saw him as kind of a weak looking guy. He was always pretty built. And I feel that the face paint that he had, it was pretty creepy. Like you said,
it was creepy.
You know, it was color coordinated to his gear, but it covered his whole face. You know, it was the closest thing to a ninja without the mask on.
Totally. You know?
And so I was really excited, though, early on when you see Terry Funk come out, because I was sitting there thinking, oh, that's right. And he's coming out and he's tearing off the poncho, and he's getting all this other stuff, and he's getting it all, you know, he's ready to fight. He's just a wily Texan ready to rumble.
I think he came out with his branding iron too.
Iron, which I think that those old LJN toys, I think his had the branding iron.
It did.
Right. And the poncho and the cowboy hat and the chaps.
Yep.
But it makes me wonder, like, Muda must have met Gary Hart at World Class, even though he was there for a short time, because I feel like World Class is where Gary Hart really cut his teeth in terms of being just this dastardly heel manager, you know? And so it was neat to see that they were right there. Were they the Black Hearts? Was that the name of this little faction? Because I knew it was like the Black Heart, Gary Hart.
I think so. I think so. They brought in Buzz Sawyer later on, when they needed to kind of go at the Horsemen. But I think in like the week prior, they broke Dirty Dick Slater's arm in the match right with the branding iron, I believe. And Dirty Dick Slater, who was a heel, I think at this point they were trying to maybe make him into a face. You know, and Gary Hart's such a great talker, right? He's a great mouthpiece. And he there's a moment where the ref is down, he's quote unquote checking on the ref, and he kind of kicks the ref. It's classic heel stuff.
Yeah. On the outside. Or no, in the was it on the outside?
He just gives him the outside of the ring.
Or something. Yeah. And it's funny because Cornette even mentions at some point, you know, Gary Hart had like the towel. And he's, you know, choking, he's giving little shots, he's doing everything he can, and to the point where Cornette's even like, he's doing a little much now, a little too much here, like, you know, let his presence be felt and that should be good, but he's really overdoing it here, he's risking it, you know, he's risking getting caught. And I mean, that's kind of eventually what leads to the DQ, isn't it? I mean he's just like, screw it, I'm coming in and interfering. So I thought that was, I was amused by that as well, that we had both picked matches that ended in disqualification.
Yeah, that was totally by happenstance. It wasn't planned.
Yeah, it really was. So ready to see the babyface win the title. Oh no.
Yeah. Cause I won't get to, what happens to Sting down the road, because to me it was amazing and heartbreaking at the same time. What happens in about a month or so following this match, I think at the Texas Shootout, Clash of Champions, but, Sting, you know, I think he had a match in at Starrcade of 88 with Muta perhaps, or it was either, it might've been later this year. I'm trying, my memory bank's foggy. We will cover that match for sure, because it's a great match. And, you know, this was the time when the babyface didn't always get that win. Get that win, and that was what made it even more exciting, because you never knew what was going to happen. You never knew what kind of run-in was going to happen. I didn't expect Funk to come in. I mean, I did on one hand, but
he comes in early though. He comes in like with the first like 5 minutes or so, hops up on that apron just wily, you know. And so, yeah, I didn't expect that either. And it's one of the better versions of Terry, you know, where he's just
my favorite
Texan. Yeah, the branding iron. How can you go wrong with that?
The hardcore. He was, you know, he was hardcore before ECW. Like he was bringing that edge. And his rivalry with Flair up until that point, when Flair was a babyface for a cup of coffee or whatever, was fantastic too. You're like, you kind of rooted for Flair. You're like, I want to see the side of Flair. And then you get the side that we're all accustomed to.
We got to see the Flair as babyface thing too, though, because those are such short segments in his career, you know, when he would be babyface. So you just mentioning how Sting was, part of that Four Horsemen, I was just kind of like, oh my God, like this is
mind blowing.
Completely. I'd forgotten all about that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, I think Sting ends up doing two of the Stinger splashes in this match, right? But I don't think we even get the mist in this match, do we?
No.
So, like, you know, what's so great about so many of these matches is that they're not throwing everything in there. Then, like, what do you come back with? You know,
exactly.
What I mean? The fact that they could keep the fans so engaged and just the intensity with the audience based on what they were doing. And again, it's because the technique was delivered so just the realism behind it. You know, there was nothing that looked like it was whiffed. There was nothing that looked like it was predetermined or that they had rehearsed it. There was none of that stuff. And it's because a lot of that was oftentimes, from what I gather, called out there on the fly. I mean, you would kind of have a rough blueprint.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was kind of winging it and going on what you hear from the audience and kind of adjusting that way. So it just makes it so much more impressive to me. And that's why I think a lot of it does come off so real, is because in many ways, that's as real as it gets. That's as real as it gets. You know, whereas if you were to flip on TV wrestling today, even from the lockup, every single thing, you know, is generally planned out, which is part of why it's so stale now.
Yeah. And if you didn't hit a certain move, and the crowd would be, you know, upset by that, this was the time when you didn't know what was coming, right?
Right. 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 And it just made it just makes it real, you know. Yeah. Actions are real. The selling is accurate. It's not just kind of generic hold my back selling, you know. And so it really made me want to chomp in and start getting a lot of this early WCW kind of crossing over from NWA. And I'm trying to think of when NWA kind of when that part was dropped and it was just WCW.
It was 91. Yeah. Okay. I think you know, when Flair came over from WCW to WWF, they had War Games match earlier that year. He was supposed to drop the title to he left with the title.
Yeah, he took the title with him.
Right. And then they had Wyndham and Luger at Great American Bash. And at this point, Wyndham chopped his hair off. Flair had chopped his hair off. The era had chopped its hair off. It just had a different vibe, you know? And I think that's why in this show, we will really focus on this specific decade and then toe dip into the 90s a bit. Because there were still some highlights early on. You know, this was also a time when the storyline would continue for a really long time, and the payoff might not come for 6 months. You know, it just continued and continued, and and NWA specifically on TBS had the Clash of Champions, like pay per view with the free pay per view.
That's right.
Some major moments in these, and we will cover some of those too. But this match in particular was like kind of in between. You know, it's like a chapter in between a really juicy pulp novel, and it sets up what's to become another major feud. And for me, it was also unique to see Muda, this guy Muda, that I've never seen somebody like this before. You know, I'd seen obviously the Road Warriors, and I think Demolition was obviously around at this point, And Sting, and I think Ultimate Warrior was about to come into the WWF, or maybe he was already there at this point, because this was 89. Yeah, he was there.
Yeah, I think it's like very early on, but you're getting at the face paint, aren't you? It's a different face paint.
Different face paint and intimidating without doing a whole lot. He didn't say anything, guys. Like he just looked at you. And then Gary Hart was the one that did the talking. And Gary Hart was not a weasel. He didn't look like a weasel to me. He kind of looked like offline, we were talking about Bill Lustig. He looked like from Maniac, our boy Joe Spinell.
Oh, yeah.
Looked a little like Joe Spinell to me, which creeped me out because when I saw Maniac, I was like, this guy's freaky as hell. But I wanna jump into a few moments from September of 1989. I'm going to focus mostly on television because there were some really fun moments that popped out to me. So in September of 89, the Legend of Zelda animated series premiered on the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Awesome.
And I think by most people will know the Legend of Zelda cartoon by the terrible Lynx. Excuse me, princess.
This is the Triforce of Wisdom, Link. The evil wizard Ganon has the Triforce of Power. Whoever gets both Triforces will rule this land forever. You must help me, Link.
Hey, for you, Zelda, anything.
Nice job, hero.
Hey, excuse me, princess.
It was just like the video game, and Link would hit people with his sword and hear the coin effect go off, or that, when he would shoot the power sword at people. It was a terrible cartoon, but I still loved it. It was so bad, but it was fun. In September of that same year, TGIF premiered on ABC.
Oh, wow.
89. So the original lineup was Full House, Family Matters, Perfect Strangers, and Just the 10 of Us.
Wow. Did you watch all of those? Trying to remember Just the 10 of Us. I was definitely a fan of Full House and Family Matters. I can't remember Just the 10 of Us.
I watched all of them. I remember Jamie Lunar and Heather Langenkamp were some of the daughters in this.
Okay.
He was a coach, but they were like a Catholic family. Oh my God. It was the religious stuff back in the day.
The older woman who was kind of like the house mother.
Yeah. I believe, I forget the name of the mom,
right.
Like the house mom. You're right.
When you said Heather Langenkamp, I kind of rang a bell. Cause I was like, oh yeah. Okay. Now it's starting to remember, but I was a boy, you know. It was like all these girls in the show. Now,
and the music was so cheesy. Bill Medley was doing it the best I can. It was just so cheesy. Yeah.
What can I say? I'm doing it the best I can. Leaning on nobody but me. Oh, seeing it from where I stand. Nothing comes easy. Nothing comes easy.
But I kind of like that stuff now. Back then, I was 13 or 12. I'm like, I don't 13. Yeah, I could care less about this stuff. I think I watched. I watched Full House and Family Matters, and kind of tapped out at Perfect Strangers because it was so wacky, you know, like it was so cheesy. But I like that stuff now. But back in the day, I was like, no, come on, give me The Fly of 86. Speaking of movies that came out in 89, I'll wrap it up with this. One of my favorite movies of all time, Black Rain, came out in 1989, September of 89. Michael Douglas, Ridley Scott, Andy Garcia. If you've never seen it, go watch it. Hans Zimmer does the soundtrack. Greg Allman sings the song with Hans Zimmer doing the soundtrack for it. It's amazing.
that's a great poster too. Like that poster, I remember. Because they used to advertise Black Rain in Black Belt magazine, in the martial arts magazine.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And so I remember that picture of Michael Douglas with the glasses on the motorcycle with the leather jacket, and it kind of had like a black and bluish kind of hue to the whole thing. And it was just like,
yep,
this guy looks badass.
Badass.
Like, this is badass.
Yeah. Ken Takakura, I think is like the detective in that, the Japanese detective. Kate Capshaw's in it.
Oh, wow.
Great movie. Great movie. We may need to cover that movie down the road.
I was about to say, Black Rain. It's a sleeper hit.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So that is two matches. That is Territory Marks in a nutshell.
Yeah. Wow. I want to go back to the 80s. I really do. You know what I mean? Watch me bust out an early 90s one next time.
Well, I got to be honest. You brought up Scott Hall. And before he was Razor, and then when he joined the NWO, Scott Hall in the 80s and early 90s, he may come up.
Cowboy Scott Hall.
Yes.
Cowboy Scott Hall with the big handlebar mustache.
Yeah, I loved it, dude.
Yeah. This whole era was just littered with guys who, you know, like we had mentioned earlier, looked. They were men, like they were real men. They weren't all bodybuilders. They had the hairy chest, you know, a lot of them. In the case of like the Buddy Rose, like some were pretty portly.
Yeah.
But you could talk all the shit you want from the audience. You see these guys outside the building, like you're not saying a word.
Nope.
You're not saying a word because these guys are legit. And a lot of them came from shooter backgrounds where they could mess you up. Not Tully Blanchard, but they could mess you up, you know? So,
or they could be your PE coach, like George the Animal Steel.
Steel just baffles me. Wow.
Yeah, I'll have to talk to my mom about that. He was my mom and my dad's PE coach. But quick thing. Did you notice the commentator in the Midnight Rockers Landell Summers match called Summers George Summers, I think?
Oh, he might have.
He's getting flustered. He was just like, there's so much going on in the ring right now. And
oh, yeah. And you can imagine how hot that arena was, like just temperature wise, you know, with like the sweat of these four athletes, really. I mean, the way they looked, notwithstanding, like they were still athletes. They still went, like you said, 18 minutes.
Yep.
And so,
yeah. And you didn't have someone piping in commentary into the commentaries on the commentator's ears, you know, what to say. So these guys are calling it like they see it, and it is just pure magic. So
it was great to hear Cornette as well, though, too. I mean, say what you will about him.
Yeah.
I'm always a fan of his mind. I'm always a fan of his opinions. And, you know, people may not be a big fan of his current viewpoints, but I learn something every time I listen to him, because he's just a real encyclopedia. I mean, the guy's been there, done that. And so what better person to have on commentary? You know what I mean? Like, he just has that voice too. So, you know, and obviously, you know, Jim Ross before he got, before he became a caricature.
Right.
You know, so this has been a lot of fun, like just getting to see. I'm probably gonna just keep looking up more stuff tonight and continue on, because, you know, as I'm still doing shows, not as many as I used to, but as I'm still doing shows, part of what I feel is a responsibility is to try and impart similar knowledge to the current generation moving into the future generation.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you didn't see, like, in these matches, you might see the big punch selling, and then they give you the big punch. You wouldn't see like the back forth, back forth, back forth, back forth. It just looks so slapstick, like the stuff you see today.
Yeah.
And you know, when I'm trying to share some knowledge with some of the younger guys, you know, you see a lot of these matches today, and a guy gets punched five times just to back him up to the ropes, they shoot him off, the guy reverses. It's like, what were those five punches? They didn't do anything. All I need is one.
Yeah.
And in both of these matches, nothing is thrown away.
No.
Nothing thrown away. They get maximum mileage out of everything they do. It's, you know, there's an economy to motion and an economy in the movement. Like, they really make the most of everything that they do. And that's part of what draws in that atmosphere of believability and legitimacy, you know, because if you're seeing someone get beat on the leg, but now they're doing leapfrogs and moonsaults, like, well, I guess his leg doesn't hurt that bad, you know, but,
right?
And that's why I'm such a fan of selling.
Yeah.
Because you're sitting here thinking, man, I know this is supposed to be predetermined, whatever, but I think he's hurt. And that's when the mark really comes out.
I'm sure we'll have a Steamboat match come up, because for me, he sold it like nobody else could.
Oh, yeah. There's some great Steamboat and Terry Funk. It's funny because we were talking about Terry just earlier in that
you
match.
Hit that. Yep.
Yeah. One of his big insults was you egg sucking dog.
Oh, man.
Dog.
Well, okay, I'll give you a little teaser for the next episode. Funk Steamboat could come up. It's a tremendous match.
That's pretty good.
Just saying. Yeah. Paul, this has been amazing doing this show with you, and I hope this is the first of many to come, because it's just been a blast.
Absolutely.
Where do you want people to find you on social media?
Find me in the territories. I'll be
there
in
you
the
go.
Cadillac. I'll be in my Cadillac out in the parking lot.
Find me in the yellow pages under Badass.
Yeah. Hanging out with the rats at the bar, the hotel bar.
There you go.
I'm just on social media, Instagram and Twitter only, at London Foo, LONDONFU. It's for Kung Fu, not an FU. So London Foo.
Of course.
And that's usually where I post my happenings in terms of travel, wrestling events, anything that I might be doing. It's certainly not where I sit there and compliment someone I just had a blood feud with and say, hey, where are we going to eat afterwards? Thank you for taking care of me. I love you. Hugs. Yeah, let's go shopping. No. No. Because, yes, social media, I blame you.
Right.
A lot of kayfabe. Guys are more concerned with getting likes and being popular from strangers than maintaining the secrecy of the business. So shame on all of you who do that.
Yeah, and mad props to the ones that keep it alive, like yourself. I appreciate that. And you can obviously find $2 late fee on all the social medias, Twitter, Instagram. The fun stuff is on Instagram, you guys.
Yeah.
That's where it's at. Territory Marks is under the $2 late fee banner now. So look for that stuff to pop up on our page, on our YouTube page. The links to the matches are in the show notes, so go check out those matches. Tell us what you think. Give us feedback on it, and tell us what some of the stuff you guys like. Reach out to us on social media. Reach out to us on Patreon. That's the bread and butter of $2 late fee, obviously. But hit us up. Let us know. We want to know. This is a show for wrestling fans, but it's also a show for nostalgia fans. People who love nostalgia, the 80s, all that good stuff. Because let's be honest, wrestling is one of the few professional sports that's been around from the beginning, and it's going to continue to go on. And hopefully we'll see a nice evolution of more kayfabe and more legit heels and faces and all that good stuff.
Oh, so I hope so. If you have a special memory of where you were in 86 or in 89 around this time, feel free to share it.
Yeah.
Because again, part of what this is about is sitting there and just, you know, trying to block out the CTE that we were developing and think back to happier, simpler times.
Right.
You know, definitely a magical time for not just wrestling, but pop culture in general. So
hell yeah.
It's been a lot of so much fun, Zach. I'm looking forward to the next one. I'm already going to start compiling a list starting tonight.
Me too. I might be busting out my Von Erichs family album. I'm just gonna also say that too.
So good.
And oh, by the way, If you're listening to the show and you were at one of those matches, let us know. If this, like, if that comes up, we want to know about that experience, because that's a whole other animal.
Please. Oh,
all right, everybody. So the good guys always win, even in the 80s. That's our tagline. And you know what? I think good old Ace Hunter needs to play us out. Paul, this has been great. Until the next time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Oh, listen, I just wanted to say goodbye and remind you that the good guys always win, even in the 80s.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe and give us a four... Is it 5-star rating? Don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. We'd really... Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you listen to us on Spotify, that's great too. And you can find us on the internet. Don't forget to check out our website at $2LateFee.com and follow us on Instagram and Facebook at $2LateFeePodcast. We'll see you next time.
We did it.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.